morning, everybody. Thank you all for joining us this Monday morning in Washington for hopefully a very interesting 2 days discussion on readmission measures. I'd like to introduce Helen Burston for some quick introductions.
Hi, everybody. I'm Helen Burston, Senior Vice President of Performance Measures here at NQF. I recognize a lot of familiar faces. We did pull on many of you who've been through committees before, understand our process, since this is our first expedited review. We have never done a project quite this fast before, or potentially, potentially high profile, but every time I say that, the next project comes along, we say that one's the most high profile. I think certainly at the moment, cost and resource use is consuming much of that energy at NQF, but I think readmissions is going to fall right behind. Really thrilled to have you here. This is a bit unusual as well because we also don't usually have the luxury of a day and a half for three measures. But these are quite complex and we recognize that. And we are also very much invested these days in not putting out competitive or duplicative measures that just confuse the field. So we are trying very hard and hopefully as a result of your efforts today and primarily tomorrow to have you actually give us a sense of which measure is best in class and can be used for the broader set of applications. So that'll be a good exercise tomorrow. You're a great hand. Tarun has been fabulous, really understands this work. Also, Karen Page, our lead methodologist, is here with us as well. We'll also have insights on risk adjustment and other issues. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Tarun. We are still waiting for Elliot, but I think we can go ahead and do the, just get the usual stuff take care of while we wait.
And also, I'd like to introduce our chairs, Dr. Sherry Kaplan, and also Dr. Elliot Lazar, who is not here yet, but I'm sure he'll be joining us soon. If you want to have any welcome introductions to the committee.
Well, I would just like to also add my welcome to everyone and invite a rich discussion. Just to lead off, I'm a psychometrician by training, full disclosure, so I'm a measurement scientist. My mother has no idea what I do for a living, but I am a measurement scientist. No one knows what I do, but I'm a measurement scientist. And I'm a professor of medicine at UC Irvine, assistant vice chancellor for healthcare measurement and evaluation at the UCI School of Medicine. In order to sort of frame this quickly, a little couple of housekeeping details, I've shared with you of these discussions in the past, and what would help us all move this thing forward is everybody to keep their questions and comments concise and focused. We can get a lot richer discussion, and especially responses, if there are any responses from measures developers as well. If you can keep it focused and concise, we can pedal a lot faster. So thank you again and welcome.
So I'll turn it over to our chief general counsel here, Anne Hammersmith, to do the disclosure interest.
Thank you, Drew. I like that chief general counsel. Good morning, everyone. If you recall, when we invited nominees for the committee, you were given a conflict of interest form, a disclosure form for the House. What we're going to do this morning in the interest of openness and transparency is go around the room and have you make any disclosures that you might have. To give you some guidance about the kind of thing we would be looking for is any consulting work you've done that is relevant to what's before the committee, grants or research support that you have, again, relevant to what's before the committee, and also any speaking engagements that are relevant to the work that will be done here. Don't expect you to recount your CV, and really would prefer it if you do not, because that will eat up a lot of your meeting. I want to remind you of a few things before we start. You sit as an individual. Sometimes committee members will say, I'm here representing the American Association of fill in the blank. You actually are not here representing anyone but yourself. You're here because you are an expert. We want you to know what you think, and you don't represent anyone, including your employer, or anyone who may have nominated you to sit on this committee. The other thing that I just want to give you a quick reminder about is sometimes I hear people say, I have no financial conflict of interest. We are interested in a potential financial conflict of interest, but because of the nature of the work we do, there is a possibility that there could be a real or apparent conflict of interest even where you haven't been compensated for what you're doing. For example, if you sit on a committee with a measure developer that's relevant to what's before the committee that's likely uncompensated, but that could be something relevant that we would want to know in connection with your service on this committee. So I'm going to start with Dr. Kaplan, and then we can just go around the table.
In the spirit of full disclosure, my colleague and partner, Dr. Sheldon Greenfield, and I have developed a total illness burden index, patient-reported comorbidity for total comorbidity for outpatient use with multiple different funding sources in the past. However, we've never used it to date in readmissions for hospitals, and I really don't have any experience with all-cause readmission. And in addition, I just want to clarify, I've chaired many committees of this nature, but I've never chaired an NQF committee, so apologies in advance if I make some rookie moves on sitting in the seat. That's the probable end of my conflict.
Leslie Kelly Hall, ahead next.
Mark Schuster,
excuse me, I'm just going to jump in for a minute. I neglected to ask you to identify yourself and who you are with.
I'm Leslie Kelly Hall with HealthWise.
Mark Schuster from Children's Hospital of Boston, Harvard Medical School. I am heading up an ARC-funded Center of Excellence for Pediatric Quality Measurement. We have two first assignments, one of which is to create a pediatric readmission measure, and the other, since readmissions keeps coming up in the discussions about it, I'll also mention the pediatric hospital CAPS measure, or family experience of care measure.
David Pollockoff with MassHealth, the Massachusetts Medicaid Agency, and the University of Massachusetts Medical School Commonwealth Medicine Division. I have no conflicts of interest, but I'm doing some related work that I'll mention. I co-chair the state's expert panel on performance measurement, where we are in the process of evaluating and hopefully selecting a readmission measure for statewide transparency reporting. I'm also a member of the Medicaid Medical Directors Learning Network, where all of the state's Medicaid agencies are working together on figuring out how to measure readmissions in the Medicaid population.
Tanya Alteras with the National Partnership for Women and Families and Associate Director of the Consumer Purchaser Disclosure Project, and I have nothing to disclose.
Gracie Travis, Memphis Business Group on Health, and I do serve on the NCQA Purchaser Advisory Council, but there's no conflict of interest relative to this particular measure. I also serve as Vice Chair of the LeapFrog Group.
Frank Ganassi, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Western Psychiatric. I am on a committee for NCQA on the Behavioral Health MAP program.
Ashish Shah from the Harvard School of Public Health and the Boston VA, and I don't believe I have any direct conflicts, but I'll just run through a few things. So I've done consulting work for a few different companies, including UpToDate, which is a medical textbook, electronic medical textbook company, Medco, which is a pharmacy benefits management company, and I'm on the scientific advisory board of a company called Humedica, which does analytics, but none of them really relate to readmissions. I've written a lot about readmissions. I've gotten grants studying readmissions from Commonwealth Fund, and I have a couple pending from the NIH. And as I already said, I'm from the Department of Veterans Affairs, which obviously is very interested and involved in a lot of work on readmissions. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Engberg. I'm from Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. I don't think I have any conflicts, but again, full disclosure, I serve on a WNC task force looking at variations in various outcomes. We haven't done anything yet, so I'm not sure that counts as a conflict. Some people who are direct reports to me are principal vet or co-principal investigators in an ARC-funded grant, along with the five other University of California hospitals, looking at outcomes in heart failure, including readmissions. But I don't have that directly.
I'm Jeff Greenwald. I'm from Mass General Hospital. I'm a hospitalist in internal medicine there. I have nothing to report in terms of conflicts. I work with Project Boost as a co-investigator, formerly with Project Red, and I'm the physician lead for readmissions for Partners Healthcare.
Good morning. I'm Brandon Daff. I'm the president of Fairview Medical Group, the Minnesota part of the Fairview Health Services System. I also chair the Quality and Performance Committee for the American College of Emergency Physicians, but do not have any direct conflicts.
My name is Joanne Brooks. I'm the Vice President of System Quality for Indiana University Health in Indianapolis, Indiana. I have no direct conflicts regarding readmissions. I speak at, I'm a speaker for Cadence Pharmaceuticals as well as a quality consultant, and I serve as chairperson of the Quality Improvement Committee for the American College of Social Physicians.
I'm Paula Minson-Folk. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Education Quality and Patient Safety at Harborview Medical Center, which is part of the UW Health System in Seattle, Washington. I have no conflicts of interest.
Good morning. I'm Bruce Pomerantz. I'm the Medical Director at the Casper Institute for Rehabilitation and Chief Quality Officer for Rehabilitation for Select Medical, and I have no conflicts to report.
Good morning. My name is Mark Lance. I'm from the University of Rochester. I am a professor of anesthesiology and community and preventative medicine, as well as vice chair for research. I don't really have any direct conflict of interest. I do have funding from HRQ looking at performance measurement in trauma, and I sit on a number of committees, including the Committee on Performance and Outcomes Measures for the American Society of Anesthesiologists, as well as serving on some advisory committees, one for trauma, and also the Anesthesia Quality Improvement Panel. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Richard Bankowitz. I'm the Chief Medical Officer of Premier, which is an alliance of about 2,500 hospitals. I will note that Premier has its own proprietary risk adjustment methodologies, including one for readmissions, and I don't believe that's a conflict of interest. I'll also note, since one of the measure stewards is CMS, that Premier has quite a few applications for contracts pending before CMS for the CMMI, but I don't believe that's a conflict of interest.
I'm Karen Page on the NQF staff.
I must have found the only slow cab driver between New York and D.C. I'm the Chief Medical Officer, Senior Vice President at New York Presbyterian in New York City, and I don't think I have any conflicts of interest either, but you know, belong to a number of groups that sit on a variety of committees, probably like many of us in the room, Haney's Greater New York, American College of Physicians, and so on.
Okay. And let me just add that I forgot something. I'm on the same project as Dr. Langberg, so I'm going to suggest that it's yet to produce anything. Sarah, apologies.
Okay, thank you. I understand there are some members of the committee on the phone. Is Patricia McDermott on the phone?
Yes, I am. I'm for Edna. I'm from the cooperation with Metrics Development. So we had a measure that we used and developed over the last few years within Aetna. It's not anything that is using logic from any other vendor. We've also looked at other vendors' logic, but our logic is its own, and I don't think there's any conflict of interest.
Okay, thank you. Is Mark Williams on the phone? Okay, I guess he's not on the phone yet. Okay. Is Jim Bellows on the phone? Okay. Thank you for those disclosures. Do any of you have anything that you want to discuss with each other or any questions of me regarding the disclosures that have been made? Okay, thank you. Have a good meeting.
Okay, thank you. Just want to quickly introduce our staff here. Adil Khan will be taking over starting the project introduction. Clearly, you guys have heard from Alexis Foreman Morgan, who has been great in getting materials back for our meeting as well. So I'll turn it over, and I'm sure to be, so I'll turn it over to you.
4 a.m. one. But if we want to know why we're here today, the Affordable Care Act under Section 3011 directs the Secretary of HHS to develop the National Strategy for Quality Improvement, which is called the NQS. And the NQS is used as a guide and includes a strategic plan on how to increase access to quality, affordable health care for all Americans. So the NQS identifies reduction in preventable hospital readmissions as an opportunity for success and uses an all-cause readmission within 30 days of discharge as an illustrative measure for effective care coordination. And some of the other goals that readmissions relate to with regards to the NQS for effective care coordination, prevention, treatment of leading causes of mortality, and safer care. So just a little bit about our project scope. Right now we're seeking to identify and endorse a cross-cutting, non-condition specific measure for accountability and quality improvement that specifically addresses all-cause readmissions to hospitals. And we're also going to be reevaluating under the maintenance process any measures that were endorsed by NQF before June 2009. So our meeting objectives today are member introductions and disclosure of interest, which we just finished. We're going to be evaluating the measures to determine if they meet the measure evaluation criteria, make recommendations regarding endorsement of the voluntary consensus standard, vote on the rating for each of the four major criteria, and overall on whether to recommend each measure for endorsement. Discuss related and competing measures to facilitate measure harmonization of related measures. We're probably going to get to discussing related and competing measures tomorrow, I believe. And from among related and competing measures, we're going to select which measures.
Okay, and as Adila said, we will be evaluating the measures based on our NQF criteria. And these are our major criteria. The first one is importance to measure report. And so we need to make sure that the measure focus is evidence-based. There's opportunities for improvement in quality, and it demonstrates a high impact, whether it's variation or overall less than optimal performance. And in order for the measure to continue through the review process, it must pass all of the three sub-criteria under importance to measure report in order for it to be evaluated against the remaining criteria. The second criteria, scientific acceptability of measure property. This is looking at the measure. Is the measure consistent and acceptable? Does it present credible results when implemented? So looking at reliability and validity. And in order for the measure to continue through the evaluation and the criteria process, it must pass the reliability and validity criteria. The third criteria is usability. Is this measure understandable to those who will use it, to the intended audience? Can they understand it? Can they understand the results of the measure? Looking at the fourth criteria, this is looking at, is the data available or can it be collected without undue burden? Again, as Adila stated, our next criteria is we do have competing measures, and in order for us to evaluate competing measures, the measures must pass all of the above criteria. So all of the above criteria must be met in order for the measures to be considered competing, if there are any, and in this case, all of the measures are considered competing. So today we'll mainly focus on the four criteria, making sure that the measures meet all of those criteria, and then tomorrow we'll focus on the competing discussion. So our process is an endorsement maintenance process, and what that means is we look at measures that are currently in our NQF portfolio and may have been endorsed for 3 years, and so now they're going through their maintenance cycle, and we evaluate those measures based on the same criteria that we evaluate newly submitted measures. And as we're evaluating the maintenance measures, we do solicit for new measures, in that topic area as well. So that's what we mean by endorsement maintenance. As Helen stated earlier, this is our first expedited review process. And so in order for a project to have an expedited review process, it must meet these three criteria. The three criteria are the measures must have been tested or currently in use, and that looks at our usability criteria. The measure or project must be narrow. In this case, it's readmissions to the hospital. It's pretty narrow. And there must be a time-sensitive legislation mandate for the measure. The role of the steering committee, we expect the steering committee to evaluate the measures, and we want to thank everyone for submitting their preliminary evaluations. You will make recommendations to the HUF membership. You will work with the project staff to achieve the goals of the project, and you will respond to comments received during the public and member comments, and we have that conference call scheduled. And the co-chairs will represent the steering committee on the project webinar, which occurs at the beginning or during the first part of the member voting period. I'm going to go into that in more detail, as well as the feedback meeting. And this is just an illustration of our endorsement process, and you can see what's highlighted in yellow slash green. This is where we currently are in the process with the committee reviewing the measures. And this is our project timeline. So today we're here to discuss and recommend measures. And then following this meeting, project staff will compile all the rationale and all the discussion points and put it into a draft report. And we, in that draft report, we'll list the voting, we'll list everything, all the major discussion points from this meeting, and we'll send it to the committee to review before we post it for member and public comment. And member and public comment is a 30 calendar day comment period, and anyone can comment, NQF members, non-NQF members, anyone can comment on the committee's recommendations and rationale behind the measures that were recommended or not recommended. Following the close of that period, the committee will meet via conference call on January 31st, and we'll send this information out so everyone can have it. You'll meet via conference call for a two-hour conference call to discuss all of the comments that came in regarding your recommendations.
So I will give a brief overview of the discussion format for the committee deliberations in the next 2 days. I will ask if we know where the after I go through the discussion format, it'd be great to have all the measure developers and members of the audience introduce themselves. So we'll go through each measure individually. The first measure of the day will be measure number 1789, the hospital-wide all-cause unplanned readmission measure. We'll ask each of the measure developers, as we go through the measures, to give a brief 3 to 5 minute introduction to the measure, noting that each of the measure developers submitted supplementary materials after the committee, post the initial submission of the measure. We'll ask the measure developers to focus on the updates to focus the committee. We'll then move to measure number 0329, the risk of justice 30-day all-cause readmission measure submitted by UHC, and then measure 1768, the planned all-cause readmission measure. The first measure, staff will guide the committee through the sub-criteria and the measure submissions form to familiarize the committee members on the evaluation process. For the second two measures, the committee members of the NQF staff will not guide the committee members to the evaluation committee. We expect that by the time you'll get through the first measure, you'll get the hang of it. And if there are more process-related questions, feel free to ask as we sort of move through this process. During the committee deliberations, you'll have the preliminary evaluations, which you should have received in your materials this morning, and also before attending today's session. This will help to guide the discussion on where there are major concerns for the measures that were submitted. Also, the comments that were submitted by committee members prior to attending here are also listed in these materials. This is really provided to help focus the discussion so that if there are no major considerations for various sub-criteria, we can help facilitate moving this day along. While we only do have three measures for discussion today, we expect each of the measure discussions to be very robust, particularly around scientific susceptibility, potentially even the risk adjustment model. So if there is not a major discussion around importance because of the nature of this call for measures, we can move pretty briskly into voting procedure. And I will just say that we'll also stop for various public and members' comment periods, various points throughout the committee, committee deliberations, which is listed on the agenda. And we have Nicole on the line, who the chairs will ask to open lines for public and member comments.
Sharon and I thought that it might be helpful for the group to even give a little bit of a framework in terms of what's congressionally mandated. In other words, what flexibility does the group have, and so on.
Okay. Actually, Helen, if you can help me out with this as well.
Sure. So, again, as the folks in the room like Stanford Foster probably know even better than me, my understanding is we certainly from the American Hospital Association, there is an expectation that an all-cause readmission measure would be used as part of the hospital readmission program. It is in AHCA, and we have agreed to have a measure, hopefully endorsed by April 1.
But I think we should emphasize the process is agnostic of whatever is happening. So if you all haven't happened yet, but it can happen if all of you determine that none of these measures meet the criteria, you can say that none are endorsed. So we do say we're agnostic of what is occurring, and ideally we would be putting that forward, but it's very important to just remember, truly need to evaluate the measures against the criteria.
We have introduction to... Yeah.
I'm Peggy Mosley, Vice President of Performance Measures at AQF.
And we have introductions for the members who are in the audience.
Hi, I'm Robbie. My name is Sharon. I'm one of the medical officers, also from Savannah.
This is Jerry Gallis from the National Committee for Quality Assurance. Charles Saunders from the National Committee for Quality Assurance.
Ellen Elias, National Committee for Quality Assurance.
Nancy Foster, American Hospital Association.
Jennifer Fairburn, Association of American Medical Colleges.
Graham Standard, United Healthcare.
Ron Sutter, United Healthcare.
Anna Rubin, United Healthcare. Alexa Noel, NQS.
Jeff Perrin, Yale University.
So with that, are there any other procedural questions as we begin? I know there's a lot of information sort of presented. I think we'll get to know the process as we sort of move along, but if there are any preliminary questions, we're happy to entertain them. If there are any questions, just please raise your placard as such, and the chairs will sort of lead the discussion in that fashion. I guess we'll just start. I'll give a... Should we give a brief introduction from the measure developers on this measure and any updates that you have? So we'll begin discussion of the measure, and as your colleague comes, I think we can have additional discussion at that point. So moving on to the first criteria, overall impact, opportunity, and evidence, the importance of the measure to importance of the measure and report. What this criteria is really aiming to evaluate is what is the extent to which the measure focuses evidence-based importance in making significant gains in healthcare quality and improving the overall health outcomes for a specific high-impact area of healthcare. This will be evaluated through three sub-criteria: high impact, gap in performance, and evidence to support the measure focus. Specific evaluation considerations for this project that should be kept in mind is that readmissions is considered an outcome measure, a proxy for an outcome measure, so evidence will not be required, measure developers will not be required to submit a body of evidence. However, they should submit a rationale that supports the relationship between this health outcome and at least one healthcare structure, process, intervention, or service. Evidence, however, would make the submission stronger, but is not required. As I noted, readmission is considered a proxy for healthcare status. One more slide. So the importance to measure and report is, again, a must-have criteria. The two sub-criteria that will be that we should consider here is the performance gap, the distribution of performance scores, the number and representativeness of the entities included in the measure performance data, data on disparities, the size of the population at risk, effectiveness of interventions, and the likely occurrence of the outcome, and also the evidence since the measure focuses an outcome. Again, the rating of the quality, quantity, and consistency of the body of evidence is not required. However, a rationale to support this relationship should be presented. So I'll turn it over to the chair to facilitate discussion, if there is any, on this particular measure, and then we'll move to voting once you're ready for that.
I think the first issue is whether or not people have burning issues about the importance of the measure and the performance gap and the evidence given, not the scientific acceptability, but sort of high impact performance gap and evidence given the congressional mandate. So if this is a burning, I mean, we should have a discussion about this if people feel strongly about some of these issues. But this is clearly coming from and the reason it's expedited is there is a congressional mandate out that has a very tight timeline. Has anybody got any issues around either, well, let's start with performance gap.
Customer.
Hearing none. I think that's a safe window of silence. What about evidence? It's the measure of health outcome and the reading of quality. This body of evidence does not require any comments.
I'm a little opposed by the process. I certainly understand the congressional mandate for the purpose of Congress ultimately seeing that deciding what to do with a measure they just created. So I certainly understand that there's a mandate there. But I'm back to the comment that was made earlier that we're supposed to be agnostic and look at the measures themselves. And so I'm not sure what the direction is here for us. I'm supposed to be kind of agnostic looking at the measures themselves, looking at their capacity for a different introduction, accountability and performance improvement, or we're supposed to acknowledge that there's a mandate, so we just move on.
I don't think there's any reason to say there's a mandate and acknowledge it, just move on. I think the importance is threefold, the first of which is how important overall is the issue of readmission. And I think that may be the issue that may be a bit of a fait accompli, you know, in and of itself. The issue about whether the second two parts of importance, I think, are especially important for you to consider. The second is, do you believe there's an important, that there's a significant gap in performance and variation among the entity-state measures? That's the second part of it. And the third is, whether you believe that evidence for the measure focus. And this is a little bit more complicated because this is many would consider an outcome measure, and so we really want a rationale for the evidence, you know, evidence for the rationale for the measure. But, you know, having a correctional mandate in and of itself doesn't really answer our criteria. So that's somewhat separate. I think it was just in the milieu of, obviously, it's an important general area, but it still doesn't change the fact that we need to fully evaluate and rate each of our criteria as a criteria.
I think what we're testing here is, can we move off this category relative to footprint? I think the general answer is yes. The only area where there's some discrepancy is within the evidence criterion, and the sub-criteria within that was, what is this measure of health outcome? And it looked like most of the committee said yes, and I said no. So I don't know if now is the time when I have a discussion about that. It's an outcome measure. It just didn't strike me as a health outcome.
Great.
If you don't want to have this dialogue now, that's fine.
I actually think it's a good one to have, and actually Karen was going to give you our thoughts on how we've handled this today.
Right. I think, you know, it's a good question, and it's come up in other projects where we've had readmission measures. And I think the reason we've kind of put it in the overall bucket of with health outcomes is that it is really a proxy for deterioration in health status. So although it's not really considered could be considered a utilization measure, but we're really looking at it in terms of, patients have there's something that happens that brings them back to the hospital. And so from that standpoint, it's viewed more in the vein of a health outcome because of the health status relationship.
So that sounds like a decision that's been made. I guess the question is that a decision we're interested in revisiting, or are we sort of, have we decided readmissions are a health outcome? And if we have, then I don't need to sort of revisit that, but I just want to know if that's on the table for a discussion or not.
I think that's how we viewed readmission measures up to this point. We certainly could entertain additional discussion about that. It will have implications beyond this project. So if we want to be consistent with precedent, then we would consider it a health outcome, but that doesn't mean that we can't have new discussion, a new way of looking at things that would perhaps alter our approach to these.
Does that require that then the measures developers go back and provide the evidence of quantity, quality, and consistency of somebody that has suggested this is an outcome? Because it does have implications for what was submitted.
So I guess, I don't want to just cut it off and say, no, we're not going to revisit that. I guess my question would be, what is it that you're...
I'm not convinced it's a health outcome. At the same time, I'm not trying to create trouble on it. Meaning, I know there's been a long process here, and I really don't, this is not like a burning platform that I want to revisit this issue. So if there is broad consensus that this is a health outcome, I'm comfortable with that, I can live with that, and we can move on. So I guess I'm just trying to test the waters of how much room is there for discussion around that, knowing that if you say, there's not a lot of room, I'm not going to feel like I've been shut down. I got my two cents in, but I personally am not convinced it's a health outcome.
Well, I guess I would ask the group, is there, is there strong sentiment one way or the other? In other words, are others, having a problem considering this health outcomes measure, or are we simply in the sort of shape of great nuance region? Perhaps others are going to speak up. I'm personally okay with it, although I understand that there could be two sides to it.
And I think we should characterize it as a proxy for health outcome. Because I agree that people would look at this and say, why is that a health outcome? So I think it's important that we kind of talk about it.
I'm not sure this is the right time either to discuss somewhere in this process as well, but As for whether it's a good proxy for health outcome, I think much of that's going to depend on the discussion about the level of adequacy of risk adjustment on these things, the level of adequacy for controlling in that risk adjustment for many of the variables, which some of these things have addressed in varying levels, like other factors post-hospitalization that have major impact on readmission, which may or may not be connected to what we traditionally think of as health outcomes. SAS chaos, a variety of different kinds of issues which post, you know, 7 to 14 days after admission impinge on an individual's health status, which may contribute to readmission, which is in no way directly connected to the outcome of a health intervention. I'm not sure where that's going to be discussed.
Well, the risk adjustment will be discussed under scientific acceptability and measure properties. In terms of the discussion about adjusting for things that happen after the hospitalization, the way NQF has viewed readmission measures is really an integrative measure and shared accountability measure. And so the readmission measures are really unique in that they have an element of utilization, they have an element of health status and what happened in the hospital, and they also have an element related to transitions of care and care coordination and our health system. And that's one reason that they're considered really important measures. It's also a reason that they generate discussion and questions. Our goal is to have measures that really do move us for better care coordination, better care in the hospital, better transitions, and this is a very integrative measure in that respect. When we talk about the scientific acceptability, risk adjustment, and what factors are included and how that impacts the validity of the measure, I think that's where we would want to have those discussions.
So that's going to happen in a different section?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
So it's one of the four who rated as not a health outcome. I'm perfectly fine moving on because I think in fact that we can spend 2 hours on the discussion. I'm not going to change my conclusion about the overall importance of the measure, which I think is the broader question. So I'm very comfortable with this. So I don't want to be labeled a troublemaker like the Chiefs.
We'll make sure that doesn't happen.
In terms of all costs, remember the breadth of this is 38 all-cost readmission, and just sort of remember that as a proxy for everything wrong that could happen. And suboptimal outcomes attributable to a variety of different sources, the decision is made to view this as anything that puts you back in the hospital within 30 days. So just to kind of keep that. Yes.
I would just like to say I agree very strongly with Frank and Brent that these are dilemmas, and in the sense that all outcomes are either intermediate or incomplete. Even death is incomplete if your real concern is satisfaction, happiness or something else, then I think we can agree this is at least an intermediate outcome. It's not a process in the sense that we're not asking whether this was applied for the benefit of the patient, so we're not considering it a process measure in that sense. The process measure is where we infer this obligation to prove the evidence. So I would agree with what everyone said, that in that sense we have sort of met this mark, and I do think a lot of the difficult discussions here will be around the scientific acceptability.
Bruce, do you mind just introducing yourself and if you have any disclosures to the group?
Yes, sorry. I apologize for being a few minutes late. I'm Bruce Hall, and I'm at the WashU in St. Louis, and I also am the director of the NSGIP for the American College of Surgeons in Chicago. At WashU in St. Louis, I have a corporate position with BJC Healthcare, so my only disclosures would be that I have a corporate role for BJC Healthcare and that I am involved with American College of Surgeons National Surgical Quality Group.
Well, it sounds like this conversation is over now, but I just wanted to say, from the patient and the consumer perspective, readmission is a real health outcome, it's a real concern, and something that we, it's obviously a proxy, but it's also a matter of, real life issues that the patient and their family have to deal with. So we do like to think of these as outcome issues.
So, if there is a
particular question, there's no need for a vote if there, but we can just move to vote on the board of measures and support.
Okay, is there a consensus that we are okay to vote?
Troy, we're asking the procedural question again. This being the first time I've gone through this process, this being the first three, so we're going to cut our teeth on this. If it turns out later on, I think that topic ought to be addressed elsewhere. It turns out groups that should be brought up here. Is the process flexible enough to revisit that, or once we vote on this, it's done? Because I'm not sure what's going to be later, what's going to be able to push and talk about now. It's hard for me to really kind of parse it the way the experts in the room have.
Yeah, I think in general, we will walk through each of the criteria today. You'll have a lot of opportunity tomorrow when you do the side-by-side comparisons to rehash a lot of the discussion, I think.
I think the question is, can he re-vote if he changes his mind tomorrow?
Not unless the committee's desire is such that they believe new evidence has emerged and you agree and probably would have to take a vote to re-vote. If you decide to do that, that's certainly within your purview.
I think that answer was probably not. But, so is there everyone is in agreement we should be voting on this part of the criteria right now? Anyone can have a vote?
Okay, so does anyone have a voting clicker?
Anyone should have one.
Yes. I actually don't have one of these. It looks like that.
I'm sorry, maybe I did miss this earlier, but so how are we going to work? Are we going to walk through all three measures before making final decisions? You mentioned how there's a side-by-side and all that. When will that happen, and will it be before or after final decisions?
The side-by-side is tomorrow, so it will be asked today. If I'm wrong through it, you'll vote on each of the four criteria, as well as an overall assessment of does the measure meet all criteria for endorsement. You will not make a recommend decision until after your side-by-side competing measures discussion tomorrow.
So this is Patty McDermott on the phone. We're voting on the first question, and we're going to, and is there a way that I would vote based on being on the phone?
We'll just ask for your vote after the fact.
Okay, so the instructions are on the PowerPoint. So voting won't start until there's a timer, and we're actually going to do a test vote so we know that the voting is working properly. You have 60 seconds to answer the question. You only have to press the corresponding button once. The last button you press is the one that we will be capturing. So you can change your answer if you like. Whichever one you press last, that's the one that's staying. You don't need to use the send key. You can change an answer. Once all the ratings have been captured, the timer will stop, and the results will appear on the screen. So just as a test, we wanted to ask you, isn't the weather in Washington, D.C. great today? So you have 30 seconds. So if we can have everyone enter their responses.
And Dana, how do you know if this thing worked? Is there some light? Does it light up, or does it just...
No.
At hard.
It did work, because we got everyone's response.
So we'll know.
When you press it, you'll get a little green light, and that means it's working. If you would get a red flashing light, you need to let us know. That means the battery's low, but...
So, the weather is great today. Well, I guess those from up north, they think the weather is incredibly hot here. Okay. So we're going to move on to then vote on importance. So again, we have the same procedure. Once I start the clock, you'll have 60 seconds to enter your vote. And you'll start your
I think you have two people holding out, so everyone can try it one more time.
On a vote of 17 to 1. And a member unthrown.
I'll go with the majority.
18 to 1. So what I'll do is I'll start to move the discussion into the scientific accessibility, reviewing the we have the measure developer who joined us. We'll offer you 5 minutes for an introduction to the measure, specifically focusing on areas that were updated from the initial submission.
Hi, I'm sorry. Okay, so I'm Brian from the Yale Center for Applied Research and Evaluation, and we developed the measure for the Center for Applied Research, as you know, and in 5 minutes I wanted to give you a quick overview. I think you know the features of the measure and review the in-depth application and the technical report, but I wanted to highlight as well the goals that were behind the work that we did that explained why we put the measure together the way that we did. So, in brief, as you know, this is a measure that divides patients into different kind of. Can I use this thing? Sure.
Hi. Okay, so we divided patients into 5 different patient cohorts, a surgical cohort, a cardiovascular, cardiorespiratory, neurology, and a medical cohort. The medical cohort includes patients not falling into the other areas. And then we developed a standardized, a separate model for each of those 5 patient cohorts that estimates the standardized readmission ratio. We roll those up into a summary score. Either the individual scores or the summary score could be reported, but our emphasis is on the summary scores, although we tested all the individual 5 models. And then I just want to point out a particular feature, which is we only count readmissions in the measure that are unplanned. And so we have a specific algorithm that identifies planned readmissions and doesn't count those in the outcome. And so what were we trying to do in developing this? You have already touched on some of on our main goal, which was to develop a measure that reflects quality of care. And in addition, we wanted to develop a fair measure that could adequately characterize, fairly characterize, very diverse U.S. hospitals, and also a useful measure. To address the concern, which we had many, many long discussions about as well, about how to capture readmission, the quality signal that readmission provides, we've specifically shaped both the cohort of patients in the measure as well as the outcome. And let me just give you an example. So the measure is very inclusive. It includes almost all patients admitted to the hospital, but we do carve out patients for which readmission we don't think is a quality signal. And we identify a particular group of cancer patients admitted for medical care of their cancer. And these patients just look very different. They seem different potentially clinically, but lots of patients differ clinically. But they look different in that they have very, very high mortality rates. And when we developed a model for that group and compared it to the other groups of patients, it didn't move with the rest. We hypothesized, and there's some evidence, that there's a hospital-wide signal of quality captured in a hospital-wide readmission measure. And we should see some relationship across these groups of patients in the quality signal, and we, as we report in our application and our technical report, didn't see that for this group of patients. So they are not in our measure, although many cancer patients are in the measure, for example, cancer patients admitted for surgical care. In addition, for the outcome, as I mentioned, we carve out planned readmissions, and here we were really not trying to, we didn't want to create a measure that discouraged routine patient care just because it happened to be occurring within 30 days of a prior admission. So, for example, a patient admitted for gastroenteritis 3 weeks earlier, that they had a gallbladder removal or something scheduled. We didn't want to discourage that. So we identify those admissions that are for planned care, and we don't count them as readmissions. Finally, we chose a modeling strategy, hierarchical logistic regression, that really tries to separate what part of the outcome is due to patient factors that we can risk adjust for, what's due to case and case mix differences, what's due to chance, and what's due to quality. And this is particularly important for a small volume hospital where chance is a big factor. One thing that's great about a hospital-wide measure is there's a lot of volume, so the measure functions really well, but we did think it was really important to characterize the amount of the outcome that's due to random variation and not count that as a quality signal. And then our second principle was fairness. There we were just trying to make sure that all the hospitals and patients we included we can truly risk adjust for, and the hospitals could be, their case mix could be accounted for, and we pulled out a couple of groups of patients there. We do not apply the measure to PCS-exempt cancer hospitals because we really, their patients are just fundamentally different. We don't have a representative mix of patients. In addition, we can't include admissions for patients who leave against medical advice. And there's some patients, like patients admitted for primary psychiatric treatment, that we don't include because they're variably admitted to acute care hospitals in general. They're not taking care of acute care in acute care hospitals. And those differences we felt would really have a fair measure, which is easier to take them out. It's relatively few patients and very few hospitals. And then lastly, we really wanted to build a measure that was useful for both public reporting and consumer information, as well as for quality improvement. So we tried to be very pragmatic in constructing the measure. We just used inpatient data to build the measure. We used 1 year of data. We think that the measure's feature, where we've separated patients into 5 cohorts, is really useful because it gives hospital subpopulations that are essentially cared for, often cared for by different clinical care teams, so they can have more resolution in the measure results if they want to look at that, or if CMS or others using the measures want to report, provide those separate results. And then more recently, actually, since we submitted this application, we tested the measure in all payer data. And like another measure before you, it actually performs even better in the 18 and over. When we say all payer, we limit it to 18 and over population, and so that it can be used in a much broader range of patients. So to summarize, we really were trying to develop a measure that provides captures the quality signal associated with readmission that's fair and that's useful, and we're really looking forward to your comments.
Any general comments or perhaps some questions for the presenter? Okay, so shall we move to the issue of scientific accessibility? I don't know if this is a reasonable question to ask from Santa Regis. I was wondering, can you talk about the advantages or disadvantages of using risk standardized readmission rates versus risk adjusted?
The terms are used pretty interchangeably. We use risk standardized here because we're using hierarchical logistic regression, which is technically risk standardizing, but it's very, very much like a more traditional logistic. At the patient level, we're adjusting for patient factors using logistic regression, just like many other risks. So that's our first step. We use logistic regression to adjust for patient factors. You'll hear the word risk standardizing in the other models. It's a very different approach. So that's a good distinction. And I mentioned point out, in this model, which is different than other models that we've put in front of NGOP, which have been more condition-specific, we adjust for both patient comorbidities and for the condition for which the patient is admitted, because we're trying to account both for differences in how sick the patients are, but also in what they're coming in for, what kinds of services the hospital provides, since the proportions of those services vary so much across hospitals.
Okay, so let me try it a different way.
people do use those terms interchangeably. I think the general, I guess, let me get more specific. Can you talk about the advantages and disadvantages of using a hierarchical model versus a straight logistic regression model?
So I have a gentleman who's our statistician here in the back too, but I'll give you a definition or an explanation. I think that fits at this juncture between where most of us work, between clinical and statistical considerations. The patients are that we're using to assess quality are clustered within hospitals, and their outcomes are related by the fact that they're being treated at the same hospital. So that's called clustering. The data is, in a sense, hierarchical. We're evaluating hospitals, but we're using patients within those hospitals to assess quality. And so one advantage of the hierarchical model is it accounts for clustering. There are other ways to do that, but that's one of its strengths. Another advantage is that it treats smaller hospitals different than large hospitals, in that it weighs the number of cases in calculating a risk standardized rate. If there are very, very few patients, say 5 or 10, the hospital does, and the model does not make as much of an inference from those patients' outcomes, whether they're readmitted or not, as it does if there are, you know, hundreds of patients in that hospital. So the uncertainty, the hospital weights, and this is different than some other approaches, an assumption that if we don't know anything about the hospital, we will assume that this hospital is a typical hospital, and all of the cases that we see will help us pull away from that prior assumption. So smaller volume hospitals in our model tend to have more average estimates, and also the model allows us to characterize the uncertainty around the estimate, which is another very important thing. So then when we're reporting, we know how much of this, how confident or how not confident are we in the rate that we're seeing. If you have any more detailed questions, we'll switch to Karen here and can get into the mechanics of the statistics. And
so I think we all understand that there's importance of clustering of patients within hospitals, and you've got to account for uncertainty. There are lots of ways of doing it, and without getting into the details of the modeling, which we might need to do in the scientific discussion, I was just trying to get on a broad level what the advantages or disadvantages are that you guys see of using the hierarchical model versus just a straight-out logistic with clustering and showing uncertainty around that. But I can wait till the scientific discussion.
Sure. Yes. We're right in that phase. Okay. So I think a number of us just from the experiences around the world would like a little more discussion. Whether it's a statistician or how you find it, it's a good idea.
How about that? Okay. You're correct. There are many ways to model these kinds of data. And I could understand your specific question. I mean, do you want to know? If you want to compare our methods with some other specific method, you know, we can discuss the comparison, but our assumption is that there's some latent signal of quality of hospitals that we want to measure in hospitals, and the HGLM approach that we use explicitly models that sort of latent factor of quality. So that's how we choose that. That's helpful.
Jeff, can I follow that up? In other very tricky estimator type models, the random effects model without volume is a poor estimate, especially the lower performing hospitals. Can you talk a little bit about how the approach, and I understand hierarchical models that can account for variations in reliability associated with lower volume, can you talk about the specific effect of volume on this particular problem?
The specific effect of the hospital's volume on which
part? On all-cause readmission as a in random effect in string congestionator type problems, random effect model.
Well, in any such model, the volume of patients, the number of observations you have within a cluster, affects how well you know the estimate for that cluster. So certainly when you have, whether or not you're using a RandomFX model, if you have a small volume hospital, you know the readmission rate for that hospital with less precision than if you had a bigger hospital. The RandomFX model acknowledges that, but also incorporates other information you have about readmission rates in general. So we know that we can expect that a hospital, without knowing anything else, has an average readmission rate, and we can combine that information with. So I don't know if that answers your question,
well,
or if I even understand your question.
What I'd like to ask is more specifically, what's wrong with adding volume to your model as a hospital characteristic?
What's wrong? I don't know that it's specifically wrong to do that in a technical sense. I think it's a policy question whether you want to do that.
So let me just to kind of expand on that, because I think if you haven't been having this discussion recently, it may be hard to follow. When we're building these models, we're trying to adjust for, we're trying to level the playing field across hospitals. So we're adjusting for patients' comorbidities, and in this case, we're adjusting for differences in the kinds of services hospitals provide. You know, elective surgery is a much lower readmission risk than, say, taking care of, you know, very sick heart failure patients or running an ICU. So we're adjusting for those things. There are many more things we could put into the model to make the model better predict readmission, and one of them would be potentially volume. But if we did that, small volume hospitals, this is a big area of debate, and there's a lot of literature on it, but small volume hospitals often look worse. And so we'd be saying, well, gee, for you, we're going to make you're going to look worse on this measure, essentially, just because you're small volume. And so it's a fairness issue. You could do that. You could separate hospitals out and say, well, we'll set a separate prior assumption about how good you are, and we'll weigh it in your, in our numerator, we do a calculation. We don't do a body count or a readmission count. So we could weigh a prior assumption about their quality, and that they're worse than an average hospital because they're small. I think you would hear back from small hospitals, that's not fair, but it is probably, if you're a consumer looking on the other end, you might say, well, gee, that was more, that may be more accurate. And so we're not trying to get the most accurate model. This will come up when we talk about adjusting for, you know, there are lots of things that make the model predict readmission better. We're just trying to level the playing field, and that's why we don't do it, but it's not good or bad. It's just a policy decision.
Leads into, I think, the usability evaluation that we'll get to later. But when it comes to the consumer looking, if there's a smaller hospital, they might look worse. You know, the fact is, if you go into hospital compare, all the hospitals look the same when you're using the hierarchical risk model. You know, they're all in that different from the national average, which is useless to consumers. And I also don't really know if it's very useful to the hospital if they're trying to improve quality internally to do that question. They have the actual data. And I know that, you know, in theory, a consumer could drill down on hospital compare and see the actual readmission rates. They're not going to do that. You know, it's hard enough just to get them on hospital compare in the first place. So, you know, my real concern, I think this is an ongoing issue that we're not going to solve today, is trying to get away from the hierarchical risk model, which doesn't really, I don't know how to balance the fairness versus the providing useful information, conflict, but I think we're tipping very far into fairness and getting very far away from providing information that's going to be useful, and we're not supposed to be thinking about the congressional mandate, but I think, you know, we can't really get away from that, and how is this type of modeling going to play into creating useful information to fulfill the requirements of OCRA? It's a big concern for me in thinking about this measure.
So this is very helpful, and I guess I have two kind of broad thoughts on this. One is whether you choose to account for volume or not in the model is a decision that has real implications. But by choosing not to, the assumption is small hospitals are no worse than large hospitals, which we know from countless studies to be just not true. And so by shrinking their estimates to the national average, basically what you do is you take all the small hospitals and make them look about the same. I understand there are political considerations, but if I guess my bias is if I had to come down on one side or another,
this as a quality improvement tool and this as a tool for consumers trumps any unfairness that you might introduce to some small hospitals that actually do pretty well. And so we're not going to get away, we're not going to come up with a perfect choice, but it's, on one hand, it seems to me that the choice is give a number to consumers that's the actual number for the hospital. And if you look at, even if you drill down on hospital compare and look at the actual readmission rate, for a small hospital, that's mostly coming from the national average, not the hospital's actual performance. It also makes it sort of uninteresting for hospitals to focus on improving because they look at their numbers and say, we're doing fine. And so if the goals are quality improvement and consumer engagement, the current model strikes me as problematic. If the goal is extra fairness in small hospitals, I think it succeeds quite well.
Let me just sort of focus and refocus this. These are questions for the developer, and we're kind of moving into the group discussion about scientific accessibility. So are there any more questions for the developer?
I have a couple of questions, not at all statistically related. The first question is whether or not any data is risk-adjusted for socioeconomic status.
We did not adjust for socioeconomic status. We present data in the application where we show that across hospitals, different proportion of Medicaid patients, there's a wide range of performance on the measure. We did look at and think about options, but didn't feel like it was necessary in this case.
That's three questions. Okay. The second question is that if a patient is admitted to a hospital other than one that did the original discharge, that will count as a readmission. So that's a statement. My question is there any way in the methodology that you use that the specific information about readmissions to other hospitals would be available to the original hospital so that they can be set for performance improvement?
And that's a great question. I mean, CMS decides how to report that. And to date, they haven't provided that in the publicly reported condition-specific measures, but there's ongoing dialogue about it. So I would just encourage you to keep pushing CMS to give that. Initially, just the barrier to, you know, privacy, reporting what happened to that patient and where they ended up. I know many hospitals have said it's useful, it would be useful information to have. It doesn't get reported in our rate, but it's potentially information CMS could provide.
My third question, and then I think I'll stop for the moment. It has to do with the timeliness of the information available to the hospital for performance improvement and to the consumers for their engagement in whatever use they want to have. How soon after a discharge period would the information be available to the hospitals and the public? If it's the next month, let's say, that would be pretty current. If it's a year or two later, then it's pretty useless for performance improvement from a hospital point of view, unless you have the consumers to deal with it. So somewhere between 1 month and 2 years, I'm guessing what it is. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I think that these are, right now, we built the measure on Medicare fee-for-service claims data, and we built it using 1 year of data. So typically, to have really good quality data, the claims are in, and CMS has done their quality checks, you'd want the most recent admission to be within a year. So it would be basically a year to 2 years from the date of reporting, which is longer than people want. And the trade-off is if you use more recent claims, the claims are a bit less complete. So I just say that for this measure, for really, you know, having confidence in the claims, it's probably between the 12 months and 24 months prior, which is a lag. It would be great to identify ways to provide other kinds of information that show more current trend. Our group is thinking about that, but it's not part of this measure.
That's an important question. So given that we're dealing with data that's a year to 2 years old, and we're the focus of our review of the measure is on accountability and performance improvement, do you have information about the utility of the measure in those settings that spur performance improvement and accountability?
I would defer more to measure users in hospitals, I would just say, you know, hey, in hospital, these numbers get looked at and they're real and they're acted upon. It's only been a couple of years that the results have been in place, so there really hasn't been for the condition-specific measures. So I don't think we have studies showing, and you know, how quickly people are reacting to them.
Okay, we have a number of questions on the table. We just want to make sure that they are all questions for the developer. So Frank, Tanya, Brent, and then Richard.
Thank you. Just two specific questions. One was about the decision to exclude psychiatric patients, and I believe it quotes that the reason was that many or most are treated in, I think you said, rehabilitation facilities or specialized psychiatric hospitals. I'm not sure about the accuracy of that statement.
Right.
I think if you look at the numbers, you may find that there are a lot of folks treated in single units within acute care hospitals. There are data available on that. I don't have them immediately at my disposal, but I'm not sure I agree with that reason for exclusion, number one. And therefore, I have concerns about that, especially since it may also have implications for how you factor comorbidity of psychiatric disorders into admissions for other medical conditions, which may seriously affect readmission rates. Second question is about, I believe you had a 12-month continuous eligibility clause built in prior to the index issue. And while I understand that because of claims issues, I'm wondering how you factored in the potential differential impact of excluding those individuals, given that there are many factors which could be acuity linked that would account for discontinuous eligibility.
On the psych patients, it's a relatively small number of patients coming out of the measure. I'm going to have to look it up. I apologize on that number off the top of my head. But we really, it's patients who are admitted for an acute psych diagnosis. There are other psych patients in the measure who come in for medical problems or who come in for surgeries. And it was just a small number, really not evenly distributed across hospitals. That was the concern. Like, most hospitals would code them in different ways. So then they would go to a rehab part or a psych part of the hospital and not show up in our data. So I think if we, just given the Medicare fee-for-service data, it didn't seem like we'd be accounting for it uniformly across hospitals to include them. I can look up the number for you in a minute if you don't want to hold up the group. And then...
But I just want to add, I don't think the statement that they're usually treated in rehab facilities or specialized psych hospitals is accurate.
Right. Let me pull the information up. I can, whatever's easiest, I can flag it for you. But again, we're just the primary, they're coming in for primary psychiatric care. If they come in for something else, then they're in there. And those are the ones that are usually not at least spending very much time in acute care hospitals if going there at all. And I forget your second question. Do you mind?
You chose a 12-month
eligibility
clause for the index admission, and I wondered if you'd accounted for potential differential impact of discontinuous eligibility on acuity.
I don't think we looked at that specifically for this measure. We looked at it in other measures, but I don't think we looked specifically at who was falling out. We had the proportion of patients falling out, but not their diagnosis. So we could go back and look at that if you're interested.
I had a quick question. In the surgery/gynecology cluster, did that include obstetrics?
No, we did not include obstetrics in the measure because we built the measure on patients 65 and older. But when we tested in all payer data, we still didn't build an obstetrics cohort in that group. In all payer data, we used California's all payer data set, but we could. It's just that given our development data, it really wasn't applicable.
When you said that you could have something that could happen, you know, is it feasible to include obstetrics data?
I'm just saying, as measure developers, we're open to including that in an all payer specified measure, but we have really haven't had time to explore it at all.
I wonder if you could speak to the use of the specialty cohorts in general. It's a broad question about that. The rationale cited in the document was that conditions cared for by the same team of clinicians are expected to experience similar added or reduced levels of readmission risk. I understand that the categories from a claims perspective are mutually exclusive, but my guess is that the care teams
going to be much grayer as far as those different categories when you look at hospitals across the country. I just wanted you to speak to that.
Yeah, and we started and we spent a lot of time thinking about and looking at data about what should we do, one model that puts everybody in one, you know, cohort or 150 models? You can kind of find examples of everything out there. And we were wondering whether we needed to break up the cohorts quite a bit to adequately account for the amount of variation in service mix across hospitals. We can risk adjust, but we just didn't know, you know, some, like there are specialty surgery hospitals, all these different types of hospitals, do we really need to break the cohorts up so we'd be fairly assessing hospitals? And we're balancing also consideration of sample size. One thing great about the hospital-wide measures is it's a lot of sample size, so you only need 1 year of data, and the shrinkage concerns are not, you know, very big. I mean, it's great to, you know, have fewer cohorts to get more sample size. So we could share more with you, but basically when we looked at the statistical issues and it looked like we could get really good risk adjustment just with our five cohorts. And in the end, we felt like we have slightly better model performance if we keep it in five cohorts. Particularly surgery has a much lower readmission rate, and we didn't want to blend that in. But the arguments weren't mostly statistical in the end. We forced everybody into one cohort. It's just that we felt that the measure would be more useful, even though it doesn't approximate care teams exactly, that's for sure. It would be more useful to hospitals, and it performed slightly better statistically to keep it at a level of five cohorts.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question about the decisions regarding socioeconomic status. You presented in your technical paper some data about the percentage of Medicaid patients in the hospital, and it looked like there were pretty substantial differences between the low Medicaid hospitals and those with greater than 30% Medicaid. So given those differences, why did you decide not to make that part of the model?
So this is a really tough issue, and I don't think we know how much socioeconomic status, you know, what the sort of cause-effect sequence is between that and readmission rates. And we don't want to adjust away differences in socioeconomic status if it's fair not to, because we want to elevate the disparities. We want this measure to, you know, highlight disparities across hospitals. If hospitals serving lower SES patients are really lower quality, we want to highlight that. If we adjust for it, we won't see that difference. So I think it's both consistent with NHS guidelines and with our own philosophy. We don't want to adjust for SES unless we have to, because it makes that difference invisible. And so then when we look at these performance differences for SES, we do see some hospitals with high proportion of Medicaid patients doing very, very well on the measure. And so we think it's fair to hold them to a benchmark as a group of sort of an average hospital. And that was the rationale.
So what do you think accounts for the difference you demonstrated? You did demonstrate quite a difference. So what accounts for that? Do you believe that those hospitals are systematically biased against Medicaid patients?
I think it's a mix of factors, and some of it may be, you know, the part we don't want to hide is quality, but some of it may be resource availability, both at the hospital and then, you know, the patient's own support as they transition from the hospital in the community. But trying to figure out how much is what is not really, I mean, people are doing research, we're thinking about that, but we can't pinpoint it. And so we really, again, at this stage, we didn't want to hide those differences. I think we feel like if there are hospitals that are having a hard time doing well in the measures, the policy answer is not to adjust away their differences, but it would be to and this is what I'm getting outside the measure developer realm, but it would be to respond to those hospitals with the support they need to do better, not sort of give them a different measure result.
Yeah, I guess it really depends on the cause of that difference, which I think at this point is pretty much unknown.
I just want to give everybody a little bit of a process check in terms of the time, and also just remember that the questions for the developer are really more on the should be really more on the technical nature. We're starting to edge toward the issue of debate around the measures, and obviously we've got a specific format for that. So we noticed a number of hands are up. We would just ask you to please, you know, keep those specific to, you know, technical questions that the developer needs to answer. We'll have plenty of time to express to no opinion on the measures. So I think, Mark, you are next, and then we'll just try and close out the rest of them and then move on.
Thanks. So I was wondering, I couldn't find in there how you picked the five service lines that you focused on, but then more importantly, it seemed like you were saying in the materials that the risk adjustment variables were forced to be identical for all five. And I realize that makes it easier to present to the outside world, but I could see ways in which the risk adjustment variables might be appropriately different across the five. And as a part of that, some adjustment variables have sort of acted one way once and one way another time, or just dropped when that may be exactly the kind of variable you want to include if it's different in its the way it acts on different service lines. So if you could help me understand better the risk adjustment process, that would be great.
Sure. So we use ARCS condition categories to group patients into condition and procedure categories into condition and procedures. And we started by doing a giant spreadsheet where we looked at how all the risk variables that we typically use, we use a different grouper to group. ICD-9 goes into risk adjustors, but the propanol grouper. But anyway, we looked at how all those typical variables we've used in other more outcomes measures related, and just like you're saying, and what we found was a lot of uniformity. And we're trying to balance, there were some variables that just looked really, that didn't seem to behave in a way that would make clinical sense at all, and some of those we just took out as potential risk adjustors. We have so many risk adjustors that we have a lot of stronger, consistent risk adjustors to choose from. And we were trying to balance the, again, for usability, it wasn't so much more for complexity, but if you're going to do this measure, you need to collect data on the risk adjustors, maybe eventually out of electronic records. We just wanted to sort of get down to some reasonable set. And when we looked at the ones that we ended up with across the five cohorts, surgical, medical, et cetera, they behaved similarly. I mean, they all were effective in as a group in risk adjusting because we fit the model individually. So we take those risk adjusters, but we allow them to go in different directions in, depending on what the outcome is, because we fit five different models. So we use the same comorbidities, but the value of the beta coefficient and the risk adjustment varies depending on its relationship to the outcome in that cohort.
Okay, Jeff, we'll make this the last one. I know there are some others that are up, but we are starting to run tight on time, and we suspect a lot of this will come forward during the subsequent discussion. So, Jeff, if we can make it a quick question, then we'll move on after that.
I hope this is quick, at risk of another slight Pandora's box. You talk about, I was very pleased to see an attempt to remove planned readmissions from your measure. That was very nice. The methodology for it, however, was less transparent to me, and I wondered if you could comment more on the methodology for how you determined and how valid that has been shown to be, because I couldn't find that in terms of identifying a readmission that was planned.
Okay, so we started with conceptually just that essentially procedures and routine chemotherapy and rehab are planned and almost nothing else is. And so that was conceptually one leap that we made. And the other is admissions, in this case we're thinking about readmissions, for any acute diagnosis like an actual MI or sepsis, those things are unplanned. And we use we used those two considerations, and we looked at what, given our data, what are people being readmitted for? What procedures are they being readmitted for? And we pulled those out, and we looked at the conditions associated with those procedures. So this is a multi-step process. It's a little complicated, but we tried to write it out very carefully in our technical report. So we took the common procedures, I think they're about 30 or more, and then we looked at the acute conditions, and if those acute conditions, the diagnosis associated with the procedures, we decided whether that was an acute or non-acute. So let me just give you an example. If you're getting a gallbladder removal and you're admitted for sepsis, we're not going to call that planned, but if you're getting a gallbladder removal and your diagnosis is cholestasis or something, that's planned. If you're getting a SPCI and you're admitted with coronary artery disease, that's planned. But if you have an acute arrhythmia, that may not be planned. If you're having an MI, that's not planned. So the framework we came up with, which we try to be very transparent about, is pairs procedures with diagnoses. And the ones that we addressed were the ones that appeared in the data. I would just add that we did put the measure up for public comment briefly. We did got some comment on this and revised it, and we're actually in a process now of just consulting one more time with surgeons from specialty societies on these calls, because we want them to be as sort of well-vetted and transparent as possible.
Yeah, I think this has a lot of gut validity and makes sense from the description that you provide. I just wonder, have you done any analysis to see if you eliminate that concept, how that affects the model of plan? Because there is obviously some squishiness in these gut valid processes that are sort of judgment-based like that.
Maybe I can come back to the committee with a little more detail on this if you need it, because I'm not sure I can think of analysis of addressing the squishiness factor per se. So we looked at, you know, who falls out and what percentage, and do the percentages make sense, but I'm not sure that gets totally at your question.
We'll move on now to reliability and validity, and some of you will take us through, and then Sherry's going to make some comments.
I'll go first, because as a psychometrician, forgive me for if I'm insulting anybody in the room, but people often confound and confuse reliability and validity. So reliability is precision. It's the replication over and over again of this, if you did it a bunch of different ways, or if you did it over time, just, you know, with the same measure, which you get more or less the same answer. I love my bathroom scale, because my bathroom scale tells me the same exact answer every day. It's completely wrong, but it tells me the same exact answer. So that's reliability. Validity is accuracy. Are you measuring what you think you're measuring? So just remember that reproducibility is reliability, and accuracy is validity.
I think that was a great introduction, Sherry. I'm just going to just talk through the various components of reliability and validity that we're asking the committee to consider. And as procedurally, one of the things that I would recommend is the committee, this would be the time to sort of focus the discussion internally. And if there are further questions for developers, those are appropriate, but really this is really the time for you as a committee to come to some consensus on the information that was presented in the measure. And really the evaluation of the measure is on what was presented to you in the measure, you know, in the measure packet. So as we look at reliability and validity, we're really looking to assess the precise specifications, how precise the specifications are, and the extent of the reliability testing, either at the data element or the measure score level. And as we move to voting, where you really would measure, evaluate a measure as high as whether they actually evaluated the data element and the measure score. Looking at the validity, we're really looking to see if the specifications are consistent with the evidence. The extent of the validity testing at the data element level or the measure score level. Again, if the developers actually demonstrate both, that would be rated high. The justification for the exclusion, the risk adjustment, and whether it's identifying differences in performance. Some things to keep in mind as we're evaluating the testing, like on the next slide, is was the appropriate method used to consider the level, the data source, the conceptual relationship, and the scope of the testing, whether it was accurate or inadequate, and are the results within acceptance norms. And actually, if we go back, that will help get the discussion started. So I'll turn it back to the committee chairs on the preliminary evaluations and anywhere else you'd like to take the group. As a process check, just quick, we were set to, you know, end this session at around 12, but, you know, feel free to take a little bit more time. We would like to do that.
Okay, let's open the floor for discussion on scientific accessibility.
Yes. And they will be voted on separately.
Yes. Let's start with reliability. So precision, replication, reproducibility.
I think it's excellent. I have no concerns based on any of the stuff that's submitted that there's any issues with the reliability of the data, of the measurements. Chris?
I think the
measure as specified is very reproducible, impressively so. I'm not sure that that satisfies my concerns about whether we're reliably learning what we think we're learning from this specification. But I think reproducibility is amazingly high.
Does anybody feel differently? Okay, so should we move to the topic of validity? Who'd like to open the discussion?
Well, I will. I would. This is a major concern, and I know, you know, in my mind, validity really derives from the specification, from the method. And this group does impeccable work of the highest quality. And as a measure developer, wearing a measure developer hat, I look at every decision and I say that was rational and that's the same decision I would have made. But sitting here as a patient advocate with that hat on, again, my overall big picture concern is, are we really learning what we think we're learning here? And I have a long list of specific questions that I feel affect the validity of whether we're learning what we're learning. One is, I'm still not sure what actual time horizon is being specified. Two, the discussion we just had about whether the planned algorithm is working as proposed is a concern. Three, technically, the approach to calculating a geometric mean of the individual model results has some advantages and disadvantages to it. Fourth, the definition of cohorts. Again, as a measure developer, I say that is exactly the same decision I would make. But when I look at the cohorts, I see conditions across, I see several conditions that are listed as both medical and surgical. Looking in the medical cohort, I see fractures. Looking in the surgical cohort, I see things that I as a surgeon, don't consider surgical disease. And I'm amazed that the cohorts function statistically as well as they did. I mean, as a quantitative statistician, economist, I'm thrilled that they did, but I'm amazed that they did, because when I look at the condition lists, I can't believe that that fell out, that those advantages fell out. So, again, to back up to the big picture, I think the work of this group is amazing. I think I would have made all the same decisions, but as a patient advocate, I'm concerned that several of these issues are not resolved.
Okay. Other comments? So, I think I guess I gave some of my points earlier, but I will just say that I want to echo a lot of what Bruce said about the quality of the thinking that went into the decisions I think the measure developer made. On almost all of the specific aspects of validity, the approach to risk adjustment to exclude, validity testing, I think it's actually pretty terrific. And they've done really an outstanding job. To me, the fundamental issue is, I shouldn't say the fundamental issue, that overblows it, but the place where I get stuck is that the hierarchical model and the way it deals with a large number of hospitals essentially gives us a number for that hospital that, in my mind, is not a true representation of what's happening in that hospital. And so you can have a small hospital with a couple hundred patients, and the model will predict out that their readmission rate is 12%, but much of that data comes from the national average and not what that hospital actually did. And so from a validity point of view, I think it raises real concerns. And that's the place where it I think, leads us awry in terms of both as a quality improvement tool and much more importantly, as a tool that consumers can actually make sense of.
Can I follow up with you, Ashish? How would you know what the hospital really did? The problem with validity is, if you don't have criterion validity, you don't have something out there that's the true answer, you know, then you're kind of in trouble. You get construct validity, which is it overlaps with some other characteristic of the hospital, like volume or something else, and then you're confounding, you're in kind of a continuous sequence and confounding the problem. So how do you know what the hospital actually is?
So that's a great question, to which I obviously don't have an answer. That's easy. But I guess so if you're stuck trying to make choices around this stuff without a clear gold standard, it seems to me that this is why we have estimates based on the data with confidence intervals. So you can say for this hospital that was small, their readmission rate was 20%, and our 95% confidence interval is 10 to 40. but that's all the precision the data give you. And you're now letting the data completely drive. So that really is what the hospital did. There really was a 20% readmission rate. Based on the risk standardized hierarchical model, as I understand it, a hospital that gets a number of 20% didn't actually have 2 out of every 10 patients get readmitted. That's what the model predicts based on the choices that have gone into the modeling. And so if you're stuck on this issue, my inclination is just be as transparent as possible with the data, and it's going to give you and be as circumspect as possible about the precision of that, of those results.
Okay, I think we just, again, are moving precision and validity back and forth over some kind of transom. So if you want to make sure, I understand heterogeneity and confidence intervals, but again, validity is about something that we have to demonstrate that is related to something else that's truly related, or some criterion that we know for sure measures the overall hospital quality with respect to the admission. So I have one question to the group. How many of you have actually done risk specification modeling? Okay, how many of you have no clue what we've been talking about for a lot of these shrinkage estimators and risk specification, or at least they know the principles, but truly, how many of you would like a little more English version of this? Some. Okay, grateful. Okay, so I would just like to ask us to now, because are there any other validity issues that you all have concerns about? Because risk stratification, risk adjustment, and that sort of thing strikes me as something that came up in the last round of discussions a lot. Are there any other burning of the other 6 criteria other than risk stratification that people are concerned about?
As soon as I raised my hand as a great soul, I'm not sure this applies here, but in looking at the submission under validity, the submission included, I think, 3 assumed to be related measures of quality or performance that validate, I think, or attempt to validate the question we've just been discussing. They're the HCAHPS scores at Thomson Reuters, top 100 hospitals, and Joint Commission top performers and key quality measures programs. Those are offered, I think, as validity of the outcome of the work, if it's connected to those in some way. I was just a little mystified myself, since some of these things are black boxes in terms of how they're created, and there are hospitals I would expect not to be on there that are on there, hospitals that aren't on there that should be on there. It was mystifying to me that those were identified as the standard by which the validity was being impaired, if I understood that correctly.
What else would you have offered?
That's a really good question. I'm sure we can all get that question. Virtually everything is being asked. I haven't thought about that because I didn't get into the validity of the whole metric anyway, and that's not my expertise. So I wish I could offer a constructive comparison. I don't know that those 3 are. So that I can't offer a suggestion by itself is not validate or invalidate the observation.
Absolutely. Does anybody else have some criteria that they could propose as possible validity variables other than the HCAHPS and Reuters and the other ones?
I mean, there's a quandary here because what we put forward as better than anything we have. So to compare ourselves to other things that we don't think can do what we're proposing to do as well as we do is, you know, we're chasing tails. So I don't know that there's an answer. I don't know that there's a resolution to trying to find some gold standard when there isn't one.
I'll just offer a comment just in regards to our criteria about testing and validity testing. Actually, this is more validity testing than we often see with measures submitted to NQF because we still allow some base validity consideration for NQF measures. But in general, validity testing, there's usually not one definitive validity test. Validity testing is usually very conceptual and is built over time, and you look for consistency of results. And so ideally, you'd like to have a gold standard that you could say, yes, we have another valid measure of quality, that we know is a measure of quality, and we can compare this new measure to it. We just don't typically have those in this field of quality performance measures. So I think, you know, part of this is you as experts in the area to understand these conceptual relationships. And I think it's, you know, definitely a good question that we don't necessarily know how those other measures were built. But I think it's looking at this not as there's going to be any one definitive answer for the validity. I'm sure you may want to add to that.
Just, I want to be clear. Were you, for this part of the discussion, were you excluding, as part of the validity, the risk adjustment, or is that still on the table?
No, I was proposing that we come back, that we focus on risk adjustment, but if anybody has any other issues in the 1, 2, 3, 5, and 6 categories, we should discuss those as well and finish off with a little bit longer discussion, a more robust discussion of risk adjustment.
I just wanted to ask, if when we're talking about risk adjustment, we group it with the identification differences in performance, because I think in this case, they're very closely linked.
So does anybody else have issues with the validity testing?
I just had a question with regard to justification of the exclusion. Does that relate to any time patient preference? Is that included as well? For instance, advanced directives or where all extraordinary measures would be taken and the patient might be readmitted based on that preference from a palliative care setting or another setting.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I mean, just because the CAPS example was brought up, when I read that, I didn't know how to interpret it because a lot of those people, I think, would have been filling out the CAPS survey after the readmission based on the 30-day readmission time point and the range of time when CAPS surveys were filled out. So it seemed very predictable that if you're filling out a survey on an admission and then in the interim and had yet another admission, your experience ratings are going to go down. So it seems, I wasn't sure what methodology was used if you excluded people who filled out CAPS surveys after that readmission, but it seemed like almost an intentional setup to get the desired result.
Just with respect to your question about what other issues are on the table, I do think I would like some clarity on the time horizon, the implications of using a geometric mean calculation with potential differential variance of each of the components, and some clarity about the definition of cohorts, because many of the conditions seem to be represented repeatedly.
Other comments on either reliability or validity? Right, other than the rest. Okay, hearing nothing further, this is time to throw my scientific acceptability.
So what we'll do actually, because the further discussion about risk adjustment is yet to be had, so okay. What we can do is, if the chairs are okay with this, we can go to public and member comment in the break, come back at 12:30 for the risk adjustment discussion, and finish up with feasibility before the lunch break.
Okay. Everybody agree?
Okay, terrific. So, Nicole, if you can open up the lines for any public or member comments.
Certainly. That's star one for any public comment at this time.
Any comments from members?
Comments from anybody else in the room?
Okay, so we have a 15-minute break, and then we're going to come back and discuss risk adjustment and then usefulness and feasibility.
Okay. Everybody all set?
Before we begin, we'll start with a little more elaboration on the issue of risk adjustment / stratification. We'd just like to introduce Leora Horowitz from the Yale Group, who's had a little bit of traveling difficulty this morning, but was able to listen into a fair bit of the discussion. Now, fortunately, is here to join us in person. So, Leora, welcome, and let's move on to risk.
So the issues in risk adjustment are, as Elizabeth really nicely articulated, are to make sure we have a level playing field. So around that issue, we'd like to sort of hear your thoughts on this measure and its approach to leveling the playing field or making things other than variations in performance at the hospital level, eliminating those as best we can from the results of the assessment. Thoughts? Hank?
Just a couple. I'll be brief. I didn't see it. It might be there. But some issues that I think might affect the level playing field setting at the end of the day, that's probably the most,
right,
one of the most important variables here. Because if quality of care is going to be improved, it has to be not only time, but it has to be established and access. So I don't see any way to, at this point, account for differences in locally, regionally, by state or nationally, in differential ability of that region to provide timely and quality follow-up care. So access issues following inpatient care, how long the wait is for the next level of treatment, whether or not that's a regional variable that is differentially impacting people, I think is a fact. I don't see that built into the model at all. So if you look at the rural North Dakota, how does that compare to inner city D.C.? How does that compare to Memphis? And since they're not using ambulatory care claims, I don't see any way to adjust for that. Second, I don't see, it's been raised by several people, I don't see an adjustment specifically for patient variables that are not diagnostic codes. So issues around homelessness, domestic violence, issues that are going to affect the ability to follow through, child care issues that are going to affect transfers from people getting home to an ambulatory care treatment when they've got two kids to worry about and have to do a bus transfer. These are intangibles, but I've been in hospital systems for almost 30 years and know that these drive ability for people to follow up for care and not follow up care often affects patients. The other thing I'm not sure how they're adjusted for, it was specified in one of the other measures that we'll get to. I didn't see it in this one. Transfers between hospitals occur fairly regularly. It is rare that you see a transfer go from a hospital that's likely to be dealing with more high acuity patients to hospitals where there was more low acuity. It appears, from my experience, it's always in the other direction, that lower acuity community-based sometimes facilities will transfer cases mid-treatment that are going wrong to facilities that are more known for specialty care. And yet I believe the readmission model only accounts for the receiving hospital's performance, not the sendings. And I don't see that built in anywhere.
So I would actually like Elizabeth and then Karen to talk about adjusting away versus, you know, making a level playing field, adjusting away the variance you're trying to explain in terms of some of these issues, like, for example, with safety net hospitals or for tertiary care facilities versus assuming that what you get is what you treat and you should be doing a good job for that population.
I'll talk a little bit about, in general, the NQF criteria regarding risk factors. And we really do not recommend that factors that are generally associated with disparities in care, such as race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status, or Medicaid as a marker for socioeconomic status be included in risk models. That's our general approach. If they are included, they have to be strongly supported in terms of analysis to be included. And the general philosophy about that is that if you include them in a risk model, you're kind of accepting the assumption that outcomes should be different based on those factors. And so what we're trying to do with risk adjustment is to account for variability in the patient's conditions as they present to the provider that's giving care, whether it's a hospital or a physician or a health plan. Some of the other things you mentioned about homelessness and, you know, you could add patient education and those kinds of things. Certainly, they would be fair game for risk models. The problem that we often run into is the balancing the burden of data collection with risk models. And so a lot of times we don't have that information in a systematic way available for these various types of risk models. So that's always kind of a waiting thing in terms of balancing what data you have with what you're able to do with risk models. The other thing I'll just mention that Elizabeth talked about earlier is that when you're doing risk adjustment or risk models, you're not trying to, it's not like a model where you're trying to identify every factor that influences the outcome. Because we're actually trying to separate out the things that the patient comes with hopefully then differences in quality of care. So, you know, we could include a lot of other things in the model, which you would have a better predictive model, but that's not what we're doing with risk adjustments in these various risk models. So, you know, risk adjustment is not a perfect science. I don't know that it ever will be. But these are all things that need to be weighed, and it's not just statistical questions. A lot of it is, conceptual relationships and what we're trying to make distinctions about. In terms of the question about area resources, I'll make a comment and then you guys certainly chime in and make any other comments here. But so if you were mentioning resources in different geographic areas, if people are going to be, you know, looking at hospital compare, for example, most of the times they're going to be doing a comparison of hospitals within their geographic area. So even though you may have comparison to a national standard or a state average in terms of using this, most of the time it will be done on a geographic area. So some of that will be at play in the geographic area. But the other thing is about, as I mentioned earlier, about these readmission measures, they really are seen as driving more coordination and collaboration of care. And so they're really purposefully not trying to isolate only the hospital, because part of what they're trying to do is drive hospitals to help with transitions. And if those things aren't at play in a particular community, then those kinds of collaborations need to be developed in order to really make an impact on readmissions. So, you know, there's a lot of different things at play here in terms of what the measures are trying to drive and the realities of data and what we're trying to do with risk adjustment. But that's probably more than you wanted, but I'll stop and see if you guys want to add anything else.
Let me just interject and ask Elizabeth if there's, I mean, it's my understanding that you're adjusting for severity of the index condition and also for comorbidity. So to the extent that those absorb a lot of this other variability, they're already in your risk model. Is there anything else you want to add to that?
No, that's actually exactly what we would have said. Those are precisely the reasons that we elected not to adjust for either of those conditions.
Just one follow-up statement. I just want to reiterate that I believe that while comorbidity is essential and that adjusting for that is clearly a great idea, I think that the amount of variance accounted for by factors that are not included in the comorbidity lists may drive far more of the variance than we'd like to acknowledge in this case. And to leave it off the table because it is a burden is tempting, and as a provider, trust me, I understand about the burdens of new mandates for measurement. At the same time, I want to just caution all of us to remember that leaving certain things off the table leave us with an easier to measure product of questionable validity, much like your Bassam scale.
I totally agree, and remember that every variable you include in the risk adjustment model also has to be subjected to reliability and validity evidence in order to make the case for including it, and a lot of times those variables have really incomplete evidence to put it down on them. So now, you can call it either.
I wanted to agree with Frank on this issue of that the complex societal factors can really impact the readmission rate. And I agree with the aspiration to have equity. I also agree we need to push hospitals to have better coordinated care. I don't disagree with that. But I don't think it's quite as simple as saying, well, we aspire to equity, so therefore we won't look at socioeconomic status. Because we know that factors like healthcare literacy, access to care, the complicated lives of the dual eligibles, also even things like access to healthy food and access to healthy playgrounds, these are all important. And I don't think we can simply say, well, they're important, they might in fact influence the readmission rate, but we are not going to look at them because we want to highlight disparities. This is not a measure of disparity. This is a measure of quality. At least that's what we said at the beginning. And the stakes are quite high here. We're going to direct consumers based upon public reporting, and we're going to redirect resources based on payment to these hospitals. And I don't think we should start off with the assumption that, well, there are differences between the hospitals who have high Medicaid populations. It must be a quality issue. No, I think we should say, look, there are complex societal issues at play. If we're going to redirect resources, we better get it right. Why do we want to withhold resources from those hospitals that may need the most? So I think we need to pay some attention to this assumption about being sort of blind with regard to socioeconomic status in this particular issue, which is a very complicated social issue as well as a health issue.
So I generally agree with all the comments that are being made right now. It's not at all clear to me how much of readmission is being driven by admission diagnoses versus comorbidities versus some of the SDS factors that we're talking about. And although I generally agree with Karen's comment that in many of the risk-adjusted metric quality metrics that we use, SDS should not be incorporated in those models. For example, for mortality models, we can collect some pretty good data on comorbidities. And comorbidities and admission diagnosis is what drives mortality. Now, for readmission, it's a little bit different. For readmission, yes, comorbidities, admission diagnoses drive readmission, but also SDS, what happens in the community, access things. And what I haven't really seen here is a discussion of the relative importance of those various factors driving readmission. And if, in fact, access and SES are incredibly important factors, maybe they do need to be included in these models, despite the data collection burden that we're discussing.
just going to join the bandwagon here. Harborview is a safety net hospital and a tertiary center. And one thing, by excluding the socioeconomic factors, I think we may see unintended consequences of cherry picking. I mean, we've certainly seen it in the past where hospitals defer patients or transfers to public hospitals or tertiary hospitals. And they're not the commercial payers, I'll tell you that.
Let me just see if we can start this discussion so that SDSF, and I think parents don't have to interview you for further consideration. Is there anybody who feels strongly? Oh, I'm sorry.
Is there anybody who feels strongly that SDS should not be included in a proposed or close reefficient measure? Ashish? So we've done a lot of empirical work. My research group has done a lot of empirical work on this, and the empirical work is overwhelming that safety net hospitals have much higher readmission rates, that African Americans have higher readmission rates than whites, and that that white patients who are in predominantly minority-serving institutions have higher readmission rates than black patients in non-minority-serving hospitals. So that seems to be a funny prologue to saying why we should not include this. But let me kind of make the point on the edge of my seat before I'm about to do something completely illogical. But it sort of goes back to whether you think this is a good quality measure or not. If you fundamentally believe that readmissions are a good way to measure quality, they're a good way to measure an important health outcome, then I think there's no way we can justify including SDS, because basically what you're saying is, it's okay, you're lousy, you just take care of poor people. And that's not, I think, where we want to go off that. I think the tension here, and the reason why a lot of us are struggling with this, is because we all believe, I should say, some of us might believe that at the end of the day, this is not a great measure of health outcome or quality for the hospital. And that factors outside of the hospital's control are driving so much of why people get readmitted. And the socioeconomic status of your patient population is such a major driver that it sort of fundamentally gets back to, do you really believe this is an important quality measure? But I don't want to relitigate that, because we've already concluded and voted, I think, 18-1 or 19-1 that it is. So I think once we've made that decision, it's hard, in my mind, to justify then including socioeconomic status in the model.
Hi, I just wanted to make one more technical point that on Karen's construct, which is the alternative. There's an alternative. I'm not recommending it at all, because we do see a whole range of performance across hospitals with high proportion of low SDS patients. But an alternative to risk adjusting is to stratify your population into hospitals with a lot of low SDS and hospitals that don't have a lot of low SDS patients, for example. There's no clear cutoff, but imagine that you could make one. So then you really would exclusively be holding those hospitals with more low SDS patients to a different standard, potentially, but you wouldn't be burying their difference in a risk adjustment variable. And I just wanted to say that is the thing to have guidance, that if there's really differences and for whatever policy, fairness, philosophical reason, you note them and you don't think it's fair to report without adjusting, then it's not that you adjust, you would stratify the measure.
Okay, we have a number of other comments, so let's work back to front. Brent?
Didn't you answer your own question, though, about why there would be an exception? Because I think you laid it out very nicely. And why you would normally not want to include this. But I thought you gave the justification for why we would include it this time. Sorry, because we're saying yes, it's a quality measure. The quality measure of the system that happens to be focused on one aspect of the system, which is the hospital. And there's the crux of the matter, and that's why we would normally not include it. There's the reason why we need to include it this time. So
I don't really have anything else to say beyond what I've said. I, as you can tell, I've struggled with this, and I continue to struggle with this. I guess sort of just for intellectual consistency, I sort of believe that if we decide this is really a quality measure for hospitals, then I fall back to we should not include SDS. But and I've already sort of said how I feel about that in general. So, but I clearly am not very clear in my own head about that.
Okay, David.
I know we, with the introduction said we represent ourselves, not organizations, but I am the chief medical executive of a Medicaid agency, so the population intervening right now are our exclusive concern. And I too, like Ashish, I have concerns about including SES for the same reasons. I'm really concerned that it could adjust the way very real differences that we would like to see. I'd also like to just add one little bit of empiric evidence discussion, which is that we recently went through an exercise in Massachusetts Medicaid of evaluating all the hospitals that we contract with, that we pay in the state. There are about 70 hospitals with one readmission measure, and then arraying them by rate. And interestingly, it didn't track very well with their level of participation in Medicaid at all, with their volume of Medicaid patients. There were high Medicaid hospitals that had low readmission rates and vice versa. Now, there's a bit of a trend, but there really was not a consistent trend at all. So I'm concerned about losing differences that would be very, very meaningful.
Tanya.
I agree. So I was right. I think the going more towards stratification is the way I would feel much more comfortable. And I just want to make a comment. I'm kind of laughing inside, even though this isn't funny at all. But 3 years ago, I was on the NQF Hospital Outcomes and Efficiency Steering Committee, and we had many of the same conversations about SES and also about how much of the readmission is really due to the hospital care versus what happens after the hospital care, after the discharge. And you know, I think Frank, you said you know there are a lot of issues about care coordination, what happens after the hospital discharge, you know, all the statistics we know about, you know, the high percentage of patients who are readmitted having no family or other caregiver support locally, and you know, how that plays into readmission. But that doesn't take away the hospital's role in this. So I just wanted to bring that back up to the surface. I know we all know that since we're all here, but I just, in an ideal world, we would have a measure that included lots of ambulatory care data, data on care coordination. We're not in that world yet, and so, you know, we do want to focus on the readmission and what the hospital, you know, what the hospital data says about that.
So just to sort of, you know, bring everybody back to the task at hand, our charge for this particular section is to simply vote on the scientific acceptability of, you know, the measure processes vis-a-vis reliability, validity, and obviously risk adjustment being a part of it. I just want to make sure that we don't, you know, try and create the perfect measure. We're really here to simply make some kind of a, you know, recommendation and obviously, you know, some kind of a assessment of particular characteristics of this measure. So I know there are a lot of cards up. If anybody has a comment that is critically important to making that decision, please keep it up. If not, I think Sherry has one last comment, and then we need to vote on this session and then move on if that's okay. Sounds like a couple of cards are still up, so.
Wait a minute. If you don't mind, let me just interject something here, which may or may not help. But a very recent systematic review of risk stratification models by Ken Segarra et al., I forget what the journal citation is, say most of our risk stratification for readmission don't work. Mortality, these risk stratification models work. There are some good ones out there that have approaches that work. But we are nowhere near scientifically sound risk stratification model. And if you think SES is an easy, we are loosely tossing it around, you should sit in on some of my social sciences kind of meetings about social socioeconomic status and how the complexities in measuring that. So in the database, it is not consistently agreeing any variables that remotely touch on the issues they raise, including race and ethnicity. So just to kind of give you a little guidance on is there something in everybody's hip pocket? Absolutely not. There's not anything out there right now that's the appropriate approach to risk stratification or risk adjustment.
Okay, so critical comments now that are going to be essential for us to cast a vote on the scientific acceptability. If you don't have one, please drop the card. If you do have one, then we will get around to you. Warner.
So I think as we're talking about the validity of the risk assessment, I think it's the question at hand. One of the things that I did not hear discussed at all were statistical measures of performance. So we've looked at the measure developers do talk about discrimination and give us a little bit of information on that. And if I recall correctly, I think the C statistic was in a 0.65 range, which seems to be pretty good for this kind of a model, not so good when you're talking about risk adjustment models in general. But that doesn't really add a lot of information to this discussion. But the point that I do want to ask about is model calibration, because that really is critically important when you're going to use risk adjustment models for benchmarking. And I don't recall seeing anything about model calibration in the technical manual. And I was wondering if we could find out about that before we vote on this.
Is it in the technical report? Can you tell us the page number? Page 53 of the technical report has the model specifications, including calibration and discrimination for each of the five sub-models in this measure. That goes through to page 53 to 55. And did you want to speak to those results?
Briefly.
Can you guys bring it up on the screen? Or? So
there are, you know, what you've got in the report, there are a lot of results here, but because we have five models, but the school results. We do have the calibration results here. They are typically one calibration would be two calibration numbers would be close to 0 and close to 1, and pretty much across the board we found that we didn't find any central calibration results for any of our models. There's a lot of detail, I don't want to go through all the numbers, but I think if someone wants to listen and has specific questions about how we calibrated.
So I think one of the things that we often ask for is like risk decile plots or risk decile. Can you just describe a little bit more? I'm not sure what the calibration numbers in here, the 0 1, I'm not sure what.
We provide a little detail on the bottom where the gamma 0 we expect to be as close to 0 as possible and 1 as close to 1 as possible. And it's set that way for the development sample, and then we compare the two validation samples to them, and you can see that's very close. The risk deciles we present in the next row here. So we're looking to see what's the predicted risk for patients with the lowest decile of risk versus what's the predicted risk for patients with the highest decile of risk. And you'd like to see, again, as wide a spread as possible because you want to show that your model is able to discriminate levels of risk. And so as you can see, these range from a very low risk of remission of 9% in the lowest decile to the highest risk of remission being around 33 or 36% in the highest decile. And that's pretty consistent across all of our measures, 4 to 27, 5 to 31, sort of on that range. And that's, I think, a pretty reasonable discrimination of risk for our model.
Good. Can we move on? Okay, Brent, you got a comment? Real quickly, we're going to move on. Just need to understand better the validity thread that was mentioned around how volume is treated in low-volume hospitals in this model. So I conceptually get that basically, if you have a very low end, it's the national average is somehow almost not necessarily being substituted, but if somebody could just explain that link a little bit better, that would help me.
Jeff, you want to respond to that for your measure?
Yes. First of all, I'd like to point out that since this is all cause remission, we don't have any
hospitals that have very small volumes. Certainly for the conditions of measures, we do often have hospitals that are publicly reported that have 25 admissions. In our case, we don't have, every hospital has at least several hundred. So we're not talking about the same kind of small volume. The idea is that if you don't, there's always a trade-off when you're trying to measure something. There's always lots of trade-offs. And in this case, the trade-off, I think, is between precision and accuracy. And it may be that if you took a small hospital and you just took the number of readmissions divided by readmissions, you would get a nice number which everyone agrees that's the readmission rate. But the certainty of which you know that is very wide. I just was saying, you know, it could be a very wide confidence interval. And how helpful that is to someone, I don't know. You know, between 10% and 40%, maybe it's not very useful. One way to improve the precision of the estimate is to combine other information you have. The hospital's not operating in a vacuum. We know that our best guess without measuring it is not 0%. It's not 100%. Our best guess before we measure it is the national average. And so the logic of the hierarchical model is factor in information. And the degree to which it's factored in is dependent on the volume of the hospital. I think that there... Well, that's where I'll stop there.
You could, you could add that if the committee felt strongly that hospital volume turns out to be one of those issues that we'd like you to address. It could be added, is my understanding, to your model as it exists now.
Do you need an indicator for just sort of the hour volume of hospital?
If you at the hospital level in the model, if you wanted to include hospital volume, it could be included. It should be felt strongly that that was some kind of marker that we wanted to take into account.
Yeah, I mean, technically you could add it. We talked about before, it's a policy and measurement decision about whether you should add it. So if you want the technical answer, yeah.
I do want to just reiterate the point that, you know, a lot of this discussion, I think, derives from the publicly reported measures we have now that are, you know, that are very volume limited because of single condition. We just do not have that problem in this measure. We are not very small volume hospitals. There will be much less of this kind of averaging region mean for these hospitals because we have real data and real sense of the outcomes for the hospitals.
So I agree that this will be less of a problem with the current measure as it is thought through. I mean, I guess, first of all, one could look at this empirically. And the way to look at it empirically is look at just the small hospitals and see how different the average is based on your hierarchical model versus a non-hierarchical straight out, which is the congressional that handles clustering. And that would actually tell us, are we biasing it by 2%? Are we biasing it by 6%? And we'd actually have some sense of how off it is. Because the work we've done with looking at AMI, CHF, and pneumonia, especially for AMI, but for heart failure and pneumonia as well, says that for small hospitals, the predicted mortality, predicted readmission rate based on the hierarchical model way underestimates these hospitals' readmission rates because volume is actually related to readmission rate. High volume hospitals, on average, actually have lower readmission rates. They're more practiced. Volume outcome relationships are well established. So the fact that the model remains agnostic to volume is, in my mind, not a justifiable position to take given what we know about hospital performance.
Michael, then Frank, and then Richard, and then we're going to respond.
My comment, unrelated to any of this, it has to do with validity. And when I think about validity non-statistically, I think about variables that can impact the measure. And if those variables are not included, then it makes me wonder whether or not the measure is valid. So the variable I'm thinking about, which I've been thinking about for the last 10-15 minutes, is mortality rate. So we know that mortality rates can vary. CMS publishes that, at least in preconditions, that they can statistically be variable. You might think about a variable like mortality. I go to the extreme, and I realize we can bring readmission rates to zero if everyone dies in 30 days. Since everyone dying in 30 days is not necessarily a preferred outcome I think the public would be happy with, and perhaps others, then I have to wonder how it is that mortality is or is not considered as a potentially influencing the validity of measure. So are differences, statistically differences in mortality rates considered in this? If not, does it not influence the validity of the metric? We do know that based upon hospital compare website that there are, CMS has a statistic on this. I was involved, actually the chair was involved, in a sick hospital study that looked at differences in mortality through a process of severity adjustment that showed up to a 50% difference in mortality for heart failure patients, and also a related association between heart failure mortality and readmission rates. So the higher your mortality, the less likely that you have a population of people to be readmitted. So I was wondering whether or not that's considered, and if not,
just want to make a brief comment about that.
Yeah, we think this is a really important issue too. And whenever possible, we think it's good to pair our readmission measures with mortality measures. And so whether somebody comes up with an all-condition mortality measure, that would be a useful thing to pair with. When we've looked internally at our data comparing hospital performance on readmission with hospital performance on mortality, we do not find a consistent relationship. So it is not true that if you are a hospital with high mortality, you are therefore a hospital with low readmission or vice versa. But that said, it's always important to think about that. And for that reason, that's why we omitted the cancer patients from our model, because they do have such high competing mortality risk, we thought it was unreasonable to include them. And so whenever possible, we sort of tried to consider that for the situations that were dramatic. But again, for the existing public report measures, there really is not a consistent relationship between readmission and mortality, so it doesn't necessarily follow that way.
Okay. Frank and then Richard, we'll close this discussion out. Okay.
Just briefly, given that the fundamental purpose of this is to improve the quality of care across institutions, I just want to be clear that we're judging the validity of this based on the current set of variables that have been included in the model. I want to also be clear that there have been a number of variables raised in the room that are not included in the model that were decided against, some of which may have burden issues, some of which don't. Many of which in the model itself have been pointed to as possibly affecting potential outcome. So I guess part of it is, given this is an expedited review, we're attempting to assess the current validity of this model based on the variables they are adjusting for. Not are we looking at, is this the best we've got given what we've got to do? We're looking at the validity of the model as it stands. I just want to be clear.
That's correct, I think.
Okay.
Richard?
I guess on that note, I think there is no perfect measure, and we can't look the perfect to the enemy of the good. But in this case, we are presented with evidence in the technical document itself that as Medicaid increases, so does the readmission rate. Now, you can argue that the dispersion of the data is there, and there is, but the central tendency of the data shows Medicaid goes up, readmissions go up. So I think the burden, the scientific burden, is to explain why that is excluded on the basis of a scientific reason, not an aspirational reason. And I do think we need to be careful. We're measuring the performance of the hospital, not the population whom it serves. And if you do a little thought experiment, think about taking a high-performing hospital and just changing its population overnight to a very complex, chronic Medicaid population, do you think the readmissions rate will change? If you think it will change, then you've got to figure out, do you want to measure the hospital or you want to measure the population whom the hospital serves?
Okay. Time to vote. Sure.
Can you just read off the vote as you got to read? Yeah. Can you do that?
Sure. So we're going to vote on scientific acceptability of measure properties. So we want to consider are both reliability and validity rated moderate or high. So looking at subsection 2A, reliability including 2A1, this is looking back into measure submission form. So 2A1, we have precise specifications, and 2A2, testing our appropriate methods and the scope with adequate results. And then looking at 2B, the validity, including 2B1, specifications consistent with evidence, 2B2, testing appropriate method and scope with adequate results, and threat stability adequately addressed, 2B3, exclusions, 2B4, risk adjustment and stratification, 2B5, meaningful differences, 2B6, comparability, data sources. So if we want to vote, was the criterion scientifically acceptable, what's the criteria of scientific acceptability of measure properties? So, start voting now.
Public reporting, and is it meaningful, understandable, and useful for quality improvement
and accountability, which means that it's got a dual purpose in this case, which some of us were worried about, but further discussions on the interpretability, the extent to which audiences, the intended audiences, and it's a broad one, consumers, purchasers, providers, and policymakers, and understand the results and are likely to find them useful for decision making. So comments.
All right, and you guys are going to go for science. So I think there's some real challenges here to the usability, and they are a couple fold. The primary issue here, in my mind, is that, well, there are two different issues. One is, at least on what we've seen for the AMI, CHF, and pneumonia measures, most of the hospitals fall within expected range or don't fall out of the expected range. And so as a quality improvement tool, that's a real challenge. If we're all pretty good, it's really not clear that it's a motivating force. It would be interesting to see, and I assume that the measure developers probably know this, what proportion of hospitals fall out of expected range based on the hierarchical model. The second issue, which kind of is related, is again what happens to small hospitals. And here, if the issue is comparison, it's really easy to see a scenario where you have a large hospital with a readmission, let's say the national average is 10%. You have a large hospital with 14% and a small hospital whose actual underlying rate was 20%, but the way the shrinkage model handles it, their small hospital gets back to 11% because it gets averaged up to the mean. So what you end up doing is giving information to consumers saying the small hospital is better than the big one, when in fact you don't really have, I think, adequate evidence to make that. And so you get numbers that are not meaningful, not understandable, in my opinion, not useful for public reporting. So that's the challenge with risk standardized rates, with hierarchical modeling, is for a lot of small hospitals, it's not the hospital's actual data, it's a series of judgment calls about what is the best amount of information we have about those hospitals. And we can quibble about whether that is, in fact, the best set of information we have about the hospitals, but ultimately it's not the hospital's own performance.
Hey, Bruce?
Thank you. I just had a question, maybe for the developers, whether there's an actual specification about the degree of acceptable certainty. So, in my mind, trying to decide whether a consumer can make sense of this, I need to know, when are we going to tell them that that performance was good enough, and when are we not going to tell them that? And what that means is, despite whatever method we choose to reach our point estimate, what are we telling the consumers about the uncertainty of that estimate, and when that uncertainty says this is acceptable performance or this is not? Because I think the consumers need that to make the interpretation. And then, irregardless of how I may or may not have voted on the prior issue, I would raise the general question. If we have 18 experts in this room who couldn't decide whether the specifications meet criteria, then how do we expect the consumers to make use of the information? So that's
following up on Bruce's comments, to make it useful to the consumer, it has to be easily understood, and I think that the idea of readmission or not is an easily understood concept until you get into the details. My concern is that does the public always equate a readmission with bad versus good? And the unintended consequences, if not explained well, could be patients self-selecting to inappropriate care settings. And so my concern is really about making this understandable and meaningful requires more education and not necessarily always the idea that something is bad because it's being reported. Just a general comment.
I wanted to go back to the shrinkage issue of, and I'm seeing you're a consumer expert, but I would think that a consumer, a potential patient, would do better with seeing 10-40 than an average number with a little asterisk that may or may not be in the report, but maybe you'll be in the newspaper someday to say that average isn't really accurate. I think it's more usable if the information is more accurate and complete. But in terms of consumer testing, and I may have just missed this in
the materials, but it looked like, well, first of all, I couldn't tell what the consumer testing was, but it looked like what's been studied is disease-specific measures, and I wasn't sure if we know how people use alcohol's measures. If that had been studied, I couldn't find that it had, and that would be useful.
Well, there's actually points so far. To me, it seems to do the consumer a disservice to give them a number that's highly contingent on random variability. I don't think it's useful to tell a consumer that a hospital's remission rate is 20%, when really it could be anything from 10 to 40, and I think actually consumers are not that great at understanding 10 to 40, and that sort of makes it difficult to understand. I think it's a much more accurate representation of reality. It's not a bias. It's a genuine representation of reality to use this measure to determine the most reliable rate for small hospitals, which in many cases will be the median. Now, second, people have asked what is the rate at the point at which we call something better than or worse than average, and that's a policy decision. So currently CMS sets that at the 95% confidence interval. That could be set at other confidence intervals. That's not intrinsic to this measure. That's a policy decision about reporting. So one could take this measure and report it at the 80% confidence interval and have more outliers. That's, again, not intrinsic to the way the measure is developed. The measure is developed to be as fair and as unbiased as possible with the actual result. And then the way in which you choose to interpret that for the consumer is a public reporting issue and not a measure issue. And finally, you had asked, have consumers been tested for this particular measure or for the public report measure? We have not tested this measure with consumers for this measure, and I'm actually not aware of what testing has been done for the public.
Yeah, CMS did consumer testing to evaluate the understandability of the data on hospital compare and made revisions. And so, for example, a revision that was prompted was in the first year reporting, all hospitals that were fewer than 25 cases, almost all of them ended up in the middle bucket because they were not better or worse by criteria. Now those hospitals that are small are reported as a fourth column, which is just too little information to assess quality, which is more accurate reporting for the computer. The consumer, I think, is much clearer for people. But we haven't looked at anything with respect to this hospital-wide measure at this point.
I would agree, you know, having something that says the readmission rate is between 10% and 40% isn't useful, but I just think that this speaks to the usability of this measure as a whole, and whether, you know, what you were saying about the consumer testing, I think that the previous way of displaying this data and the current way of showing, you know, none of cases, those aren't usable either, and that, you know, this all comes down to my concerns about the hierarchical risk modeling in general. And I know that these are two different issues. There's the measurement issue, and then there's the data display issue. There's, you know, confidence intervals that have nothing to do with what the measure is, but I just, you know, my concern is about this measure and how it's specified and what the results are going to be in terms of the data display, just based on the history that we have with hospital compare.
I know there are a lot of people to get to, but let me just raise the issue of who's the consumer, because it's kind of an insult to consumers to assume that they're a homogeneous entity as well, and they come in all stripes and all flavors. Also, the proportion of variation, how often the patient chooses the hospital versus chooses the doctor who chooses the hospital, it may be an issue that's worth entertaining here when we're talking about who's reading these data.
I'll focus for a moment on the usability of the information from the hospital point of view, depending on how much time you want to give me to talk about the consumer. For the purpose of performance improvement, data that's 12 to 18 months old is largely useless. That doesn't mean that we can't learn something from it, but if the purpose of the information is to allow a hospital to apply improvement strategies and retest to see whether the strategies have had an effect, if the cycle for doing that in a data set that is so old is so slow that the ability to make real improvement would be virtually impossible on that data. So secondly, the ability for a hospital to understand the full extent of the opportunities for improvement when, at least currently, in the current version of this, there is shielded from the hospital information about other hospitals that patients may have been admitted to. It's again a deficit with regard to usability of the information for the hospital improvement. And as far as the, I can say about both the hospital and the consumers, the biggest problem I have with the usability is the patient. It's about the hospital readmission rates. It's about a hospital quality measure. For those of us who live in that world, there are variables well beyond the license of the hospital and even the function of its medical staff that we know, and I can share with you if you want to, have an impact upon the admission rates. So it's less, to me, a measure uniquely of hospital quality and more about community health quality. I think the confusion for the consumer and certainly the frustrations for a hospital would be that tag to a hospital, whether it's socioeconomic status, whether it's resources available in the community, such as effective nursing homes, whether it's distance to the hospital. A significant number of portion of the patients get readmitted in my hospital was 40 to 120 miles away. What's the reach of the hospital to be able to manage patients once they've been discharged? What's the expectation that the hospital should be accountable, and from the point of view of CMS, financially penalized if they can't manage these things? Those, to me, raise questions of the usability of the from a hospital accountability perspective.